between the wisdom passed down by ancient healing traditions, anecdotal experience, and modern clinical trials, one thing is clear: mushrooms are medicinal powerhouses. And I finally found a brand, a product, a company that I feel really aligns with all of my research and understanding when it comes to the medicinal properties of mushrooms, and that is Alchemy Mushrooms. They grow their mushrooms in California on organic mushroom farms. They keep the whole mushroom in their supplements, and they actually blend mycelium and fruit body in their mushroom powders and capsules to give you the best of both worlds. You can learn more at Alchemy Mushrooms. That's A-L-C-H-E-M-I. AlchemyMushrooms.com. Use the discount code MushroomHour for 20% off your order. Alchemy with an I, Mushrooms.com. Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we're honored to be joined by Dr. Andrew Wilson, Assistant Curator of Mycology in the Sam Mitchell Herbarium of Fungi at Denver Botanic Gardens. For Dr. Wilson, the discovery of mycology began back in the late 90s at San Francisco State University, taking classes with world-renowned mushroom taxonomist Dr. Dennis Desjardins. Working with Dennis, Andrew earned a master's degree studying the mushroom genus Gymnopus from Java and Bali. He later went on to earn a PhD in the lab of Dr. David Hibbett at Clark University. His project took him back to Southeast Asia, this time to study the ecology and evolution of the enigmatic puffball genus Calostoma and their relatives. In 2009, he graduated and began a postdoc with Dr. Gregory Mueller at the Chicago Botanic Garden, where he explored the systematic evolution of the Cantharellus and the model ectomycorrhizal mushroom genus Lacaria. He also did a one-year postdoc at Purdue in the lab of Dr. Kathy Aim, teasing apart evolution of plant pathogenic rust fungi. Now at Denver Botanic Gardens, Dr. Wilson is working on a regional contribution to the fungal diversity survey that encompasses the state of Colorado with a focus on the southern Rocky Mountains. In this effort, he is training students on how to study biodiversity using natural history collection and DNA sequence analysis. He is also working on new tools in DNA sequencing to better sample and study fungal diversity. Dr. Wilson, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you've got quite the list of accomplishments and amazing people that you've worked with throughout your career. So I'm excited to learn about all the different fungi that you studied and learn about the initiatives there at the Botanic Gardens. But before we get into it, we told a little bit of that story in the intro there. Why don't you give us the highlights of how you even came to study mushrooms and fungi and how this became your career path?
Yeah, it's something I kind of like to think about because I just feel so very fortunate to have fallen into this career path and study these amazing organisms. Both my parents were biologists, so there was probably something about nature in there that drew me towards biology and the study itself. And I think one of my first inspirations towards switching to biology as a potential career path as a student in college was I was transferring to San Francisco State University from Modesto Junior College. I grew up in Modesto, California. Right before I started my first semester at San Francisco State, I went on an two-week ecotourism trip with my father to Costa Rica. As you can imagine, that was a blast.
Mind-blowing, I'm sure.
Yeah. And so it stuck with me because the reality was I was going to San Francisco State to get a degree in humanities. I did about two and a half years at Modesto Junior College, not really knowing what I wanted to study in college. But somebody put the seed in my mind that maybe the humanities was a path I wanted to go into because I did a little bit of music and I did a little bit of art when I was in high school. And I enjoyed those topics. But when they suggested I study something in the humanities, I really didn't click what the humanities was. So right. I started to look for schools that had degrees in the humanities. Turns out San Francisco State was one of them. And being a kid growing up in the Central Valley, the San Francisco Bay Area was one of the big escapes that I had as a kid.
Right.
And of course, all of my friends kind of moved there after high school. So it seemed like a no-brainer. Went to San Francisco State, studying the humanities. Was fantastic because all of the culture that San Francisco had to offer in the early to mid 90s, there was these fascinating classes because the internet was growing as a thing. I'm dating myself here, but there was a lot of cultural exploration as to what this means. And there were courses in the humanities programs that explored this, like a course that offered science fiction texts as an exploration of, you know, what is going to happen in the future with this new technology and this new frontier of the internet. I had a blast, but then I had this introspective moment as to, okay, what are my skill sets? What am I going to be able to do with this kind of degree? It was at that moment that I realized, as much as I was enjoying San Francisco State and the degree in the humanities, I decided it was time to potentially pivot. And so I started taking biology classes because of this experience that I had with my dad in Costa Rica. You know, I was enjoying the biology courses. I made a lot of friends, and there was just happened to be one semester that I was planning on taking genetics with Dr. John Stubbs, who was the genetics professor at the time. He had been widely acclaimed by the other biology students there. So he was on sabbatical the semester that I had planned to take genetics. So instead of taking it from the substitute, I decided to pivot. And that gap in my schedule was filled very well with this course called Biology of the Fungi, taught by Dennis Desjardins.
Perfect.
And so I had heard good things about Dennis and decided to take the course. And that experience was the beginning of a lifelong love affair with mycology and the study of biodiversity and how the world of fungi remains such a open frontier on this planet for exploring diversity and how important organisms fungi are.
And this was already at a time where there was so much change in that period of the 90s, like you just said, with the internet, but with society. I mean, there was so much in flux, such a vibrant scene there in San Francisco. So fungi would seem to fit right in. And Dennis is one of those people. And speaking with a couple people that have been in his lab and around him, Jackie Shea, Brian Perry, he's one of those classic people that once you get near him, he kind of infects you with the fungi. And you have this love that seems to then launch people into their career. I mean, was that it? Did that seal the deal for you? You know, how much did working with Dennis and being around that enthusiasm, you know, really influence your career or your trajectory?
Yeah. You know, Jackie and Brian were absolutely right. When you just sit in on one of those courses, I hadn't had a professor simultaneously infuse such knowledge and understanding with excitement. And, you know, the ability to touch upon a person's sort of imagination and desire to learn more was something that's very unique or very valuable when it comes to being an effective teacher. Dennis was definitely one of those instructors where his combination of enthusiasm and knowledge, as well as explaining what his research is about and all the cool things that he's doing. And so when I started, he was just finishing up a research project that was funded by the National Science Foundation to study the biodiversity of mushrooms in the Hawaiian Islands. And so that was one of the impetuses of his first books on mushroom identification, which is the mushroom of the Hawaiian Islands. And we just learned that he was awarded his second or his next NSF grant. I wasn't sure which one this was for him, but this was to study the mushroom diversity of Java and Bali in Indonesia. So that was a 4-year project. And the first 2 years, he had funding for 2 graduate students already. And they were pretty much the graduate students when I when I got, I think I started my second class, the higher fungi, taking it from Dennis, and I hadn't quite graduated yet. When I learned about this and learned about the project and realized, okay, so he's got funding for the first 2 years of a 4-year project. That's when I approached him. I said, so if I'm doing the math right, you're probably going to need graduate students for the second 2 years of your project. And does that make sense? And he said, yes. And so with that, I asked him if he could consider me as a graduate student. And he says, well, you know, do study hard, work with me for a little while, and you will likely bring you on into the project. And so I did that, worked hard, did a few projects as an undergraduate, actually ended up taking about a year after I graduated before coming to graduate school, because that's just how the timing worked. It was kind of a great time too, that transition, because I also spent about 4 months and I went back to Costa Rica, stayed there for a while. And I did a combination of migratory bird banding and surveys, as well as working with sea turtles and sea turtle conservation.
That sounds incredible. So Costa Rica ends up being this kind of touchstone for you that keeps you on the path of biology. And then, I mean, from one tropical island to another, then you're en route to Java and Bali. So tell us a little bit about Gymnopus. You know, it's not a genus that I was familiar with. I looked at pictures, did some research before this interview, but tell us what it was like then to go in search in Java and Bali for Gymnopus, maybe a little bit about the mushroom and then what that experience was like for you.
Yeah. So at that time, I was still fairly much of a noob when it comes to studying mushrooms. And I relied on Dennis and his collaborator, Dr. Egon Horak from Zurich in Switzerland, to help sort of like form and think of a project. And one of the things that they're finding a lot of in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, are a lot of Littersat probic fungi. And Dennis is, of course, one of the world experts on the genus Marasmius. And he had other students. Atik Ratnawati was one of his preliminary graduate students working on Marasmius of Indonesia. And another group that they were finding quite a bit of was this genus Gymnopus. Now, by comparison, it's kind of one of these LBMs, these little brown mushrooms.
I was going to say, I didn't want to put down the Gymnopus, but it was kind of nondescript looking, yeah, LBM.
Yeah. That's kind of one of the fascinating things when you study fungi, because you, in a lot of cases, people would argue that you've seen one mushroom, you've seen them all, until you start looking. And then when you start looking, you start noticing all of this variation and all of these differences, and kind of was the same way when looking at Gymnopus and learning that there is all of this diversity that was there. There was, I can't remember how many species were in my monograph. I probably should have looked this up ahead of time, but yeah, and the monograph I ended up doing probably had over a dozen, between a dozen and 20 different species that were described. Maybe up to half a dozen of those were potentially new, if not outright new species. And my project was probably one of the first in Dennis's lab that combined a number of different genetic markers to understand and flesh out this diversity that we found there. So part of my graduate experience really encompassed doing this monograph as part of my thesis. But then out of it, I also got this sort of broader exploration of the diversity of Gymnopus and related mushrooms, and ended up being one of my most heavily cited papers, because these LBMs are often overlooked and people don't study them. But yet they're ubiquitous and they're all over the place. And because of that combination, people are citing and referencing this paper that we produced. So it turned out to be very important and influential pieces of work, and influential to me to understand how important using genetic information is to explore diversity.
Now, was this one of your first times really being exposed to that world of phylogeny and genetics and doing that kind of genetic sequencing, everything that goes along with that? Was this really your first hands-on experience of doing a lot of that work?
Yeah. Really, San Francisco State, the biology department there was a great place to be at the time, because that had this fantastic organismal biology community. know, people studying fish, people studying insects, plants, and they were really big on understanding systematics. Dr. Greg Spicer was a new professor there at the time, and he was a very important systematist in the department and mentored some of some really pretty big names in biology right now. Dr. Cori Moreau is called Ant Girl. She was a cohort as an undergraduate, but now she's this famous ant biologist and systematist. Right now she's at Cornell, but she was at the Field Museum in Chicago. And she got her start with working with Dr. Spicer. And Dr. Bob Patterson, who's a plant biologist, lots of individuals there helped teach me about the importance of using systematics and at least scratch the surface for me. The next real big step for me was figuring out all of the different ways that this can be used as a tool to explore deeper questions in diversity. And that's where my experience in my PhD program really took off. After I was working with Dennis and worked on him with that project, I was exploring PhD programs. And one of the places I really wanted to go to was Dr. Rytis Vilgeli's lab at Duke University. He ended up doing his PhD on the genus Colibia, which is actually where the genus Gymnopus comes from and related groups. And that was kind of a lab I wanted to go to because they were on the forefront of doing all of these systematic type research studies. And then Brian Perry, he was at Harvard University working with Dr. Don Feaster. So I applied to that lab as well. And then I also applied to Clark University to work with Dr. David Hibbett, who was also a very big name when it comes to mycology and systematics. But yet Clark University is such a small school. It didn't have the prestige of either Duke or Harvard. But ultimately, when it came down to it, there wasn't space in the Rytis's lab or Don Feaster's lab for me at the time, but David welcomed me in with open arms. And in retrospect, I feel like that was probably the best kind of circumstance for me, just to be at a school and in David's lab at that time.
I had never heard of Clark University, so just reading your story kind of put it on the map for me. And before we get into the work with callostoma, I do want to define a term because I talk with a lot of people about genetics and this idea of systematics. When we reference that, is this actually, you know, there's the process of using a solvent, crushing up the actual fungal material, using primers, doing the actual sequencing, you know, the physical process of sequencing. But when we say systematics, what are we talking about there? Is this using the information gleaned and applying it to a phylogenetic tree, or what does that term mean?
I sometimes struggle with this definition too, but on a broad spectrum, when we talk about systematics, we're talking about understanding how organisms are related to each other. This helps us inform taxonomy and understanding and describing diversity. In taxonomy, we like to put things in categories based on their differences or describing what those individual taxonomic units are, like what genera of organisms are together and what are the different individual species units within there. We like to believe that our taxonomy reflects the systematic relationships of these organisms. The study of systematics actually goes way before phylogenetics. So it actually goes back quite a ways. It's about sort of drawing the tree of life. And so in some ways, we might argue that Darwin is probably one of the first people to really communicate what systematics might be, because he was talking about the tree of life and a branching of all organisms. And from that system, the field of systematics was born, because we are looking at, traditionally, with a lot of organisms like plants, you're looking at phenotypic similarities, how organisms look and appear. What are their flower structures? How are like irises related to each other? How are orchids related to each other based on fundamental appearances? And it's through those phenotypes that we're arguing that these things are related and or how closely related things might be different from each other. Systematics can actually use character evolution and phenotypic markers to measure those relationships. Later on, when we start when we're able to actually analyze the genetics and the DNA sequences and other kinds of genetic markers, then we can compare the phenotype with the genotype to understand how our interpretation of the phenotype reflects the phylogeny or the phylogenetics, which is how we would map those systematic relationships using the genetic information.
Okay, I'm just starting to grasp that difference now. So it's that idea of seeing how they're related to understand how they work together in a given system.
Right.
And so, yeah, naturally, macroscopic observations versus genetic data is going to lead you to some very, very different pictures. So hence, I'm sure systematics, especially in your time, was changing wildly as more and more genetic tools came to the table.
Right. Yeah. So the ability to do something like polymerase chain reaction and then sequencing to get that DNA signal or that DNA data took a lot of the guesswork out of it, because traditionally when you're doing systematics, you want to try to use data that's objective as possible. So you're measuring flower parts, you're measuring the shapes of leaves, and then you're plugging that into something like a data matrix where you want to use or quantify what those differences are between organisms to then sort of draw what those patterns of relationships are, like how these two species might be related to each other. Are they relative to a third or fourth or a dozen different species? The problem with doing phenotypic data is that the interpretation of the value of that information is left on to you.
It's highly subjective, yeah.
It kind of is subjective. As much as we try to make those kinds of determinations objective, there's still a hugely subjective component as to what is valuable. The DNA sequence data removes a lot of that guesswork for us because the data is what it is. There is a challenge there as to how you best analyze the genetic data, because how you analyze it can be somewhat also open to interpretation and employs a certain level of subjectivity. But the data that you get is relatively objective. So the phylogenetic process was a great leap forward in our understanding of organismal systematics.
So even in interpreting genetic data, someone could weigh certain genetic similarities differently.
Yeah.
And this is, thank you so much for breaking this down, because this gives some insight into the next epigenetics, which is you get this data, and then what do you do with it? How are we building these trees, deciding what's related? And I mean, at the end of the day, it comes down to plugging in this data in some kind of matrix, and then humans have to make decisions on what's relevant and how to connect things to some extent. So it's really interesting to hear that backstory.
Right. It's kind of fun to try to be in this field and slowly but gradually get it. Like, you start off with these, like, I don't get it. You know, like, you're sitting in these classes and you might be napping in the back. And, you know, I remember taking classes with Greg Spicer, and Greg's a great guy, but some of his classes are sort of loose and he just approaches the subject very casually. And so you take a casual approach to it and you kind of get a little bit of it, but then there's a lot of it that's still very gray in my mind. But over time, and even though I'm still unsure about a lot of different things, I understand the process well enough, and I've gotten a lot of confidence to say, like, this is what this application can do, and this is what it can't really do. And we need to find some sort of common ground to understand, you know, what is the data telling us, and are we interpreting it correctly? And this is how the scientific method is very important, because even though I have an interpretation of the data and I might tell a story based on this data, I also rely on my colleagues to give constructive criticisms, to tell me that I'm way off base, and just to essentially help me understand how I might be applying something right or wrong. And over time, I'm learning at the same time, but I'm also helping to tell the story and push back the veil of nature and help other people understand what's going on in the world with these organisms. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. And for me and anyone listening who's more of a layman, it's interesting to hear that process, there's understanding the language, if you will, of the base genetic data. And then there's kind of a mixture of art and science in deciding exactly how this applies and forms taxonomic groupings. And that's, I know a lot of people have heard about the debates of, you know, why are mushrooms changing species and names? And it is because people have these different interpretations and are gradually trying to decide collectively what the data is showing us. And I have heard that some scientists stick with their own names because they think the general consensus doesn't have it right. So that's really interesting to hear. Well, then getting us back on track with being in Dr. David Hibbett's lab, what was that next step, that next stage of work for you?
Well, first off, it was like getting used to living in Massachusetts after having lived in California all my life. That was a shock to the system. But I think I feel also very fortunate because, you know, David is fascinating, was great to work for, and the lab was welcoming. And Brian Perry was also 45 minutes away east in Boston and kind of was a little bit of an anchor for me that first year, because otherwise I was probably a little too homesick otherwise. And it was a change moving from San Francisco to Worcester, Massachusetts. That was a shock. But after that first year, I kind of got my bearings, and I also wanted to work with David to try to design my own project and figure out what I wanted to do. He was very open to that. And so it took me about a year of studying and figuring things out. And one of the things he came to me with was, oh, I don't know whether or not he gave me a paper or started discussing something, but he started talking about the genus Calostoma because they were growing in his backyard. And it hit me because I can't remember why exactly, but there was a couple different things and a couple different reasons why it was valuable to work on. I first read about Calostoma when I read a paper by Brandy Huey. She was actually an undergraduate at Michigan State University, working with Gerard Adams, and David Hibbett was a co-author on that paper. And in that study, she had sequenced the DNA of Calostoma and found out that it wasn't related to these other stalked puffballs, because Calostoma is really weird. It's comes out of the ground and it's sort of a little puffball, but it's raised on this gelatinous, weird kind of veiny stalk.
Yeah, it's wild. Yeah.
And because of morphology, because we rely so heavily on the morphology at the time to figure out relationships, the other group of stalked puffballs is the genus Tolostoma. So the assumption was that they were related because of this morphology. And because of that connection that mycologists made, they assumed Calostoma was a saprobe. So it decomposed organic materials, basically plant material.
And this is an example of applying those systematics to try to figure out right. more about the organism based on that relationship you're inferring.
Exactly. And so Brandy, what she did is that she sequenced the DNA, and the DNA says it's actually related to the boletes. And as we all know, the boletes are in a very important mycorrhizal group of fungi, right. forming these important symbiotic relationships with trees. I thought that was an interesting thing for David to suggest, now knowing that he's got specimens in his backyard that we can study, that he'd studied it before. And I think the third nail in the coffin was one of the postdocs in the lab was Dr. Manfred Binder. And he did his PhD defining this group of puffballs that are in the boletales. And it turns out Calostoma falls within that group. So there was a number of different interesting questions there. One was, okay, so if Calostoma is part of this boletales group, but it's traditionally thought of being saprotrophic, what is it really? Is it saprotrophic? Is it mycorrhizal? How can we find that out?
That's the million-dollar question, yeah.
Yeah. Other questions are like, how many species of Calostoma are there? Is it a diverse group? Is it not? Lastly is like, where does it really fall within this larger group of puffball boletes? And through this, I kind of started off on my project. I applied to defining these three different components. What is the diversity of Calostoma? Can I do a monograph on it? Where does it fall systematically within this larger group? And what is its true ecology? I applied for a National Science Foundation doctoral dissertation improvement grant, which grants you up to like $12,000 to study or improve your graduate work. And in getting that, And exploring the diversity a bit more, I realized that the diversity of this group expands way outside of Massachusetts and into Southeast Asia, also into Australia a bit. So it gave me an opportunity, and I guess this is also a very good reason why I picked up the project. I mentioned to Dennis that I was interested in studying calostoma because he had gotten a new grant to study mushrooms in Southeast Asia. And he says, oh, well, I'm just happened to find to be finding calostoma in the spots I'm going to visit. So I go, oh, well, can I join you? And so part of my graduate work was going to Southeast Asia and collecting calostoma with Dennis and learning more about the diversity and visiting some of these cool tropical spots in peninsular Malaysia and then Borneo, Malaysia, finding a number of different species and specimens and collecting them and adding them to my study. But it's also a learning experience in that I kind of began to explore these different ways of answering questions for the ecology portion of the project. We did a number of different things. I searched for Calostoma cinnabarinum within the state of Massachusetts, and there I found four different sites where I would collect the specimens, and then I would dig dirt from beneath them to try to find ectomycorrhizal root tips. Even though I may find ectomycorrhizal root tips, what I needed to do is make sure that the fungi growing on the root tips matches the DNA from the fruiting bodies, so I can make that connection that the fungus is growing on these root tips. In addition, I can also identify what plant is growing on those root tips because I can sequence fungal DNA specifically or the plant DNA specifically from that same sample. And I think the next thing that we also explored was isotopic information was starting to become more and more important to explore nutritional habits from different fungi. Dr. Eric Hobby is a professor at University of New Hampshire, and one of his big research areas is looking at fungal diversity ecologically. And he helped explain that if you look at carbon and nitrogen isotopes in different kinds of fungi, you can put them in one of two different categories because where they get their carbon and their nitrogen from is dependent upon what their ecological role is. So generally, mycorrhizal fungi fall within one kind of category or one kind of nitrogen carbon profile, and saprotrophic fungi fall in a completely different profile. So that combination of molecular sequence data, looking at morphological information from the root tips and the connections to the mushroom, and the isotopic data were combined into a single paper to explain that, yes, calostoma is actually mycorrhizal in its environments. Another thing I kind of got out of that project is that I had only four populations that I was looking at, but each one of those populations, it was only growing on oaks.
That was another big question is, yeah, who is it associating with? What's the host specificity? All that kind of thing. Once you can establish it's mycorrhizal, opens up all kinds of new questions.
Right. You know, just because I had only found it on oaks, it wasn't the nail in the coffin. This was,
right.
It could be growing on something else, somewhere else, for all I knew. But in making these observations, I would see and I would find calostoma growing in other places in North America, like the Adirondacks in North Carolina. I would hang out in some of the forests there for a little bit and find some calostoma. But then I'd be looking around and say, well, okay, well, what are the possible hosts? There always seemed to be oaks around. I also knew that colleagues were finding calostoma in Central America. So going, oh, great, this is cool. Well, where are you finding him? It's like, well, our study happens to be focused on neotropical oak woodland communities.
Okay, so we got a common theme of the oak. Can't right. escape it.
And so oaks belong to the family Fagaceae. And so there's a couple of different other genera within that group, Castanopsis, Lithocarpus, a couple important tree genera. And it turns out there, Dr. Paul Manos did some of the biogeographic history of the Fagaceae. He's was at Duke University. And so I kind of was looking at the diversity of oaks and the biogeographic history of oaks and learning about this through the diversity and distribution of the Fagaceae. Paul Manos argued in his research that the Fagaceae actually originated in Asia, possibly Southeast Asia, and then dispersed out of Southeast Asia into North America and other parts of the world, and then, you know, east from Southeast Asia into Europe, or sorry, west into Europe. I said, wow, this is fascinating. This also probably helps me understand why there's callostoma in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, there's a definite overlap there, yeah.
And so I started looking at the diversity and where the diversity is distributed, and it turns out there's probably about three times as many callostoma species in Southeast Asia and Asia than there are in North America. There's also a number of species that occur in Australia and New Zealand. Through this, I'm starting to get this picture forming and started becoming fascinated with biogeographic history. Like, what is this, the underlying story of these groups and how they got where they got? This ended up forming the sort of the thesis of my third chapter of my research, which actually explored the larger biogeographic history of this group, the Sclerodermatinii, which the callostoma is within. From that, I got a lot of the similar patterns. Like, I could say definitively, callostoma, based on its distribution and its associations, originated likely in Southeast Asia and then expanded from there. And then there's a couple other groups within that larger subfamily, the Sclerodermatinii, that had similar biogeographic patterns. Some of them expanded much more than callostoma did, and are also found on a variety of different plant hosts. So they're able to,
okay,
to perform a host switch to other different plant hosts to a degree that was beyond what callostoma did, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. There's still some outstanding questions that I have when it comes to callostoma, because it turns out you can find callostoma in Southeast Asia, in Australasia, and Australia and New Zealand in Nothofagus forests, which is kind of a group that's related to Nothofagus. But you also find them growing on in eucalyptus groves, which is a different family, the Myrtaceae. So at some point, callostoma was able to switch its hosts from the Fagaceae to the Myrtaceae when it moved into the Southern Hemisphere. But for whatever reason, being in the Northern Hemisphere, it stayed on oaks and stayed in these with these hosts within the Fagaceae.
Now, biogeography is always so fascinating to try to trace the trail of organisms, especially plants and fungi, because they're static. So to see that idea of movement, maybe how they moved. Now, was the core tenet of your theory about callostoma specifically, was some a lot of that based on this idea of its host, the Fagaceae, started there as well? Or did, I'm guessing you had to add some other data points to make sure you could argue that that was the nexus point and then it expanded from there, other than just kind of another theory that Fagaceae started there.
Yeah, I mean, it's still kind of a working theory. I haven't been able to continue to explore it, but one of the ways you can sort of explore a hypothesis is through phylogenetics. And
right,
when you have a lot of different specimens and you create phylogenies for them, the phylogenies should, in theory, draw out a pattern of evolution that maybe explains some of that history. I don't want to say it's sort of like reading the tea leaves, but that there is a pattern there that should reflect some of the history and either support or cause you to revise your hypothesis. With the callostoma phylogeny, which definitely needs more work, there are examples of species of callostoma that are found in Southeast Asia that have fairly peculiar morphologies. They're almost like a very stripped down form of callostoma, very simple features. And when you throw them into the phylogeny, they sort of come out at the bottom of the phylogeny as part of one of the early diverging ancestors, or one of the early diverging lineages that is related to one of the common ancestors for the whole group. And I happen to sort of like finagle the language there to be accurate. It probably sounds like a convoluted set of terms. But if you imagine there's one ancestor for all of callostoma, and then all the other
right
current extant species of Calostoma are derived from that, if some of those extant members are actually directly connected to that ancestor, you can say that potentially where that specimen comes from and how that specimen looks might be somewhat in tune with what the origins of the group are, especially if you make that comparison with that specimen to all the other ones. So there's a number of different specimens from Southeast Asia that are connected to the ancestor and some early diverging lineages. Whereas, you know, specimens from North America are part of a unique group that seems to be more derived on the phylogeny. So that's kind of a pattern I'm looking at. But yeah, I have other examples too that are better than that.
Well, is that a general, when we're talking about a phylogeny and deciding what is the ancestor that diverges off into more specific speciation, is that kind of a natural output of the process? Is that you enter in that genetic data, the percent relationship to other genera lets you know, okay, this is further up our tree. So basically, as things get more different or divergent, you can tell that they were coming later on in evolution. Is that kind of a general rule of thumb? I know I'm not being nearly as specific as in my language as you were, but is that getting to some concept there behind how you can tell when you're looking at genetics, this is older or a progenitor of something else?
Yeah. You know, phylogenetic theory, it can be tricky. It's after a while being experienced with it and thinking through what is being meant and what we're seeing in the phylogeny is when we start to understand how to more appropriately interpret it, what it is that we're seeing.
Okay.
Generally, the way you kind of want to look at a tree is you do want to look at it as a pattern of relationships, but there are patterns of relationships based on organisms that are in existence today. So when I say, you know, this fungus that's sort of ancestral, it's not to say that it is the ancestor, because it should be treated equally with any other specimen that you're finding today, because it's existed since that ancestor. And right. What you're looking at are multiple different lineages. And potentially, if you have one specimen that's by itself, and then it, when you draw that line and it connects all the way to the ancestor at the base of the tree, it is part of this lineage, but for whatever reason, this is the only specimen we can find from that lineage in existence today. There might have been dozens of other species that are also part of that lineage that may have become extinct or that we just haven't found yet. But whatever happens, you need to like look at that specimen as an entity in and of itself and compare it to all the other specimens to understand the similarities and differences, to better understand how that might inform what we know about the ancestor to the group. I'm worried, you know, to an extent, you know, I'm explaining my understanding of how this works, and hopefully I'm not losing the audience too much. Yeah, phylogenetic theories, it can be challenging to understand.
Well, that's exactly why I asked the question is, you know, my understanding clearly is extremely nascent. These are tough concepts to grapple with if you don't work with them day to day. And I think a lot of us just take it for granted that when someone says, oh, well, you know, chanterelle is an older, just as a kind of a base example, chanterelle is an older type of mushroom and gills came later. So we think about, well, how are mushrooms that are still here ancestors to our current mushrooms, any organism? How do we know that this is one of those lineages? You know, I get it. Genetic data tells us that, but how do we look at genetic data and actually find that out? So it is interesting to hear the logic that has to go into it. And I like that, reading the tea leaves or seeing the tapestry, if you will. And only by doing this a lot would you start to see those patterns emerge. And, oh, this fits, you know, a general phylogenetic pattern that we see in terms of understanding this is a lineage from an ancestor species. So I appreciate you sharing your understanding as best you can, because I think for a lot of us who are laymen and don't work with phylogenetic trees, this does help kind of put together the pieces of at least what's going into making those decisions and kind of coming out with those determinations. Now, with Calostoma specifically, you said that you found, obviously, host is one part of it. Its host tree may have originated there. You're finding this ancestor there. I know that's a better one. So for you, what was kind of the nail in nailing that theory down for you that was, okay, this is pretty solid that this originated, this genera originated here and radiated from there?
Largely the connection of the data or the results that I was getting from the phylogenetic analysis, because I think it's important to take each bit of information and treat it on its own merits. Because so much of science, and we talked about pattern recognition and reading the tea leaves, so to speak, so much of science is gathering data as much as you can and looking at that data objectively in a way to where you can identify the important patterns in nature. So the reality that I'm finding all of this diversity for callostoma in Southeast Asia, that I can see that callostoma is mycorrhizal and that I'm finding it this pattern that it's always growing with Quercus. Knowing the biogeographic history of oaks was sort of established independently of these observations of callostoma lends strength to this building hypothesis that callostoma in and of itself likely started in Southeast Asia. And as oaks dispersed and radiated out from Southeast Asia, so did their mycorrhizal partners. And if it just happens with one group, why not all sorts of different groups? And so that was one of the observations I had. And it turns out other mycologists are also seeing this observation in other ectomycorrhizal groups. One of them, I mentioned it was Dr. Roy Holling from the New York Botanic Gardens. When he's looking at Bola tailies, he's seeing radiations between Asia and North America for these fungi. We're seeing lots of different patterns in other groups of organisms, mainly plants. Dr. Jun Wen has a paper that describes the intercontinental relationships between Asia and North America. So there is observations that are occurring between researchers of different groups of organisms that discuss this connection. So yeah, it's an existing and persistent hypothesis, which I feel confident we can add callostoma to very easily.
And that's interesting to hear about how, as more research emerges, maybe about other organisms, but shows recurrent themes in genetic drift and biogeography can be used then to add weight to your hypothesis. I feel like you're fleshing out what some of the scientific process is like in developing hypotheses for those of us who don't do that in our day-to-day lives. And it's a really interesting story. I think it humanizes it a lot too, which is always great. So then after that research, I mean, how did you get pulled away from the tropical islands? Because I know then you went to the Chicago mm-hmm. Botanic Garden. Maybe that research led you to tropical islands, but you know, what pulled you away from the tropics and what pulled you into research on Cantharellus and Licaria, two hugely important ectomycorrhizal genera?
Yeah, so largely in this field, you kind of tend to follow where the opportunities take you. And I've been fortunate where Southeast Asia and the tropics have been a big part of my research career. I just happened to be looking for a postdoctoral position because I was ending my PhD program. And Dr. Greg Mueller, previously at the Field Museum, he was transitioning to a director position at the Chicago Botanic Garden. He was looking for a postdoc because he had an NSF project to look at the systematic diversity of Licaria. His previous postdoc on the position had gotten a job and was leaving for Japan. And so there was a lot of work that was already done on the Licaria project. And he wanted a postdoc to help him finish that and also continue his research program when he moved to the Chicago Botanic Garden. I jumped at the chance. When I finished my PhD, I moved to Chicago. And I did not know much about the genus Licaria. To be quite honest, I'd grown very fond of callostoma and the scleroderma tinnii and was reticent to jump onto a different group. But the few Licarias that I had seen, it's kind of one of those groups. It's almost a little bit like Gymnopus. You've seen one Licaria, you've seen them all. But like I mentioned before, you need to sit down and look at Licaria to understand and respect their differences. And over time, when I started diving into the study and generating the last few pieces of molecular sequence data that we needed to develop a fully fleshed phylogeny. I was studying the phylogeny and I was analyzing the data and I was managing all of this information. And again, reading the tea leaves, looking for the patterns, this very beautiful and awesome right. pattern started displaying itself. And we got to the point where we can actually start using molecular data to sort of map out timeframes, so molecular clocks, and understanding not just how these organisms are related, but when certain ancestors, the general time frame in terms of the geological time these ancestors existed in, and then potentially where they were in the world. And this was a kind of like a fascinating part because this, we ended up publishing this study back in 2017, but we had been sitting on the data for a while and presenting it at places. And then one of the editors of New Phytologist said, please consider publishing this in our journal. And of course we did because it's a great journal. But it tells this beautiful story of how Lecaria as a genus kind of started in Gondwana, or sort of a Gondwanan sort of relationship where, and if you're not familiar with Gondwana, this is when southern continents were all connected to each other. This includes South America, Australia, New Zealand, and Antarctica. And it follows the same sort of Gondwanan pattern that this plant species, Nothofagus, covers. It explains why we see Lecaria species in Nothofagus forests in South America, as well as in Australia and New Zealand. And then we also have a wide diversity of Lecaria throughout the Northern Hemisphere. Well, it turns out what happens is that all of these species originated around when Gondwana and landmasses were connected with each other. And then as these continents and these landmasses broke apart, different lineages started remain their connections with these different landmasses. And then at some point, when Australia and New Zealand started, the landmass started migrating north, it connected with Southeast Asia. And there's one point on the phylogeny where there was a switch between Southern Hemisphere Lecaria and all of those Gondwanan-associated Lecaria to the Northern Hemisphere. And in that jump, there's one branching lineages where we find all kinds of Southeast Asian Lecaria. And then a massive radiation across the Northern Hemisphere in Lecaria between Europe, Asia, and North America. It was a really fascinating and sort of beautiful study that kind of also plays out with how, when the geologists kind of estimate these land masses were connected, that they broke apart and they started moving closer to each other. So it's that time, that original time that connects all of the land masses, that all of these Lecaria from the Southern Hemisphere are together. And then later on in the evolution of the genus, these land masses moved in the way that Australia becomes closer to Southeast Asia. And then we see Lecaria jumping to the Northern Hemisphere. And now we're going to see the opposite where Lecaria is, when its movement to North America, is now actually migrating south into South America from the north. So there's a lot of fascinating patterns going on. And one of the coolest things about the project is that we went back and started using isotopes again, because there was one specimen that was collected in New Zealand by Kentaro Hosaka, who realized that there wasn't any ectomycorrhizal hosts near this specimen. And so when we sequenced the DNA from the specimen and plugged it into the phylogeny, it's from a lineage that is rooted to the base of the phylogeny for all of Lecaria. So this is very awkward, and it looks like a Lecaria. It has a lot of similar qualities.
So an ancestor before mycorrhizal capacities emerged, or?
This was kind of a hypothesis that we were working from. We didn't know much more other than the genetics said that it's from a lineage that is separate from the main lineage of Lecaria that's in existence today.
Okay.
And the fact that it was kind of hypothesized to be free living, non-mycorrhizal, we needed to investigate that a little bit further. We only had like two specimens, So we ground up a bunch of it to get the DNA out. And so we had just a little bit more to try to get the isotope information out. And then I also got a bunch of specimens from Southern Hemisphere clades and Northern Hemisphere clades, just to make sure that we're getting a full isotopic profile from the entire group. And all of the vast majority, or pretty much all of the other Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere Licaria, formed a nice cluster within ectomycorrhizal lineages when it comes to their carbon and nitrogen isotope profile. This other specimen was way outside of that. What's weird is that it was outside of both the ectomycorrhizal group and the saprotrophic fungal group. So it was kind of its own.
I thought you were going to say it was going to be on this nitrogen side of things, but it's on neither.
It's neither saprotrophic or ectomycorrhizal. So in terms of its carbon nitrogen isotopic profile. So it's very sort of weird. As a result, you know, we hypothesized that this kind of specimen that we found recently in existence today is a relic of the ancestor and the precursor to a lot of ectomycorrhizal and what we call the ectomycorrhizal physiology. This ectomycorrhizal role that most Licaria play that has allowed for this large expansion and just diversification that we see in this group around the world. And we kind of hyped up the importance of this because Licaria has been very important for understanding mycorrhizal relationships. The first genome of a mycorrhizal fungus was Licaria bicolor. Forestry research on mycorrhizal relationships with trees have largely focused historically looking at Licaria, largely because you can culture them a lot more easily than a lot of other mycorrhizal fungi. We argued, you know, this is sort of like a model for understanding the ectomycorrhizal biology, and that this group of model ectomycorrhizal fungi has this very fascinating story to tell from an evolutionary context. So that was a really fun project.
Well, there are a couple of huge things highlighted there. I mean, first of all, finding that Licaria, to me, I think of like, imagine if you found an ancient living hominid amongst the humans. You know, you're finding this long, long, long past ancestor, but still alive. So that's explosive on its own. And then you're also marrying it with this amazing geological story. And I know Gondwana has been referenced in other research about finding tropical ectomycorrhizal fungi. Why do they show up, you know, in Africa and in South America? Oh, they were united when this was Gondwana. So that's always an incredible story to think about how the disciplines of geology, finding out those geologic timescales, and then when you're trying to track organismal biogeography, how that all works together is always fascinating. But you talked about molecular aging. Is that what we're looking at? Is kind of referencing a geologic timescale with when things start showing up biogeographically, and that's when we can say, okay, this is when certain species may have emerged or certain separations of genera. Is that how we figure out that timescale, or is there some other marker you're looking at when you see genetics that helps you determine age?
Yeah, it's looking at the other pieces of scientific information to connect with your dated phylogeny is one of the way of performing a check. It's independent of the results that you get. So when we do a phylogenetic molecular clock kind of analysis, what we're trying to do is, and this is much easier with plants and animals because they leave a fossil record behind. Right. And plants and animals, when you have a fossil, say like of ferns, and you throw in some ferns into your phylogeny, you can sort of say, well, these fossils are from, you know, 100,000 years ago. Our phylogeny sort of represents this group of ferns. So we can kind of say that this group of ferns, their DNA sequence data, if you go all the way back, there should be at least 1,000 years old. Now, over time, over 1,000 years, we can measure how much the DNA sequence should change over time. And so what these analyses do is that you have all this DNA sequence data that you're comparing against all these different organisms. And you're going to say that at this point in the relationship or this group should be about, you know, 100,000 years old. So any molecular change that's happened between this group, since then and its relationship to other groups should be relevant to that 100,000-year-old estimate. So what you're doing is you're sort of creating a scale. You're sort of telling the analysis, okay, this many changes means this many years old. It's very sophisticated. To me, it is sort of like a black box. I'm not one of these computer programmers who really understands. I understand it theoretically. I'm what's called an end user. So I like to plug in the data. Somebody can tell me how to tweak the dials, and then I get a result out. Now, whether or not it's the result is correct is something that I can presume is correct based on the instructions I've gotten when I've tweaked the dials. But to confirm that my analysis is kind of accurate, I can compare it to other data, such as what is the geological record? Does it make sense that these fungi were together at one point and then separated at another point? Does it make sense that these fungi moved from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere, given where these fungi are at the time and how they might, the land masses might have been connected to each other? So if I have independent corroborating evidence of this result, then I can feel a little bit more confident that what I'm saying is accurate. And that's kind of what of the whole thing of science. Again, finding the patterns.
Finding the patterns has been the recurrent theme. And the question then really that I should have asked was, what is the molecular time clock and how does that relate to geologic timescales? And I think you just explained that beautifully and really helped us all kind of grasp. It's still a black box. It's kind of reassuring to hear it's a black box for you as well. But to understand kind of the theory of how we're discovering these things, it helps demystify the science a little bit when people are able to make determinations, if you understand the logic that goes into it. Well, then you have this career of examining systematics, finding emerging patterns, looking at biogeography. Take us to how you got involved with the Denver Botanic Gardens. And I really want to make sure we give enough time to get into your work there. Tell us about the gardens, how you got the opportunity, and if you know it, a little bit of history about the Denver Botanic Gardens.
So the Denver Botanic Gardens is turned out to be a great location for me to end up. Being a postdoc and working in Chicago was a great experience. But of course, any postdoc will explain that you're constantly on the search for that permanent gig.
Of course.
And being a evolutionary mycologist and an individual who's very interested in looking at fungal diversity and trying to understand patterns and relationships in fungal diversity, a lot of my history has focused on working with natural history collections. So at San Francisco State University, I was in the Harry D. Tears Herbarium, collected specimens and put that into the herbarium there, used those specimens as part of my thesis. At Clark University, I was borrowing specimens from all sorts of different herbaria and fungaria, worked at the Farlow over at Harvard for a little bit. And then when I was in Chicago, I was affiliated with the Field Museum, which is where Gregory Mueller was a curator, and worked with a lot of the collections and specimens that are there. So when there was this position at Denver Botanic Gardens to work in the Sam Mitchell Herbarium of Fungi, it seemed like a wonderful opportunity that I couldn't not apply for and get involved with. So I applied like any, you know, eager mycologist would, did my interview and everything. I had gone through a number of different interviews and been disappointed with the rejections, but sort of the bridesmaid and never the bride sort of thing. And so I was very excited about this opportunity, but also trying to keep, not try to get too hopeful. And then I got the call that said, you know, yes, we'd like to hire you. And it was, I was ecstatic. And I came to Denver and the place has just sort of like grown in terms of the expectations around science and using plants and fungi to understand conservation in the Southern Rocky Mountain region. The Sam Mitchell Herbarium of Fungi is one of the most important collections of fungi within the Rocky Mountain region throughout North America. We have over 20,000 different specimens, 16 to 17,000 of Southern Rock are focused on the Southern Rocky Mountain region. And in that whole time, they've had essentially two curators. There was the individual Dr. Sam Mitchell, who was a diagnostician, a medical doctor, who became fascinated with fungi. And some of his patients were actual patrons of the Denver Botanic Gardens. And so through their patronage, offered to support Dr. Sam Mitchell's hobby and interests at the Denver Botanic Gardens. Around 1991, he passed off the reins to Vera Evenson, who is the author of Mushrooms of the Rocky Mountain Region and Associated States. And she's also co-authored another book with Dr. Kathy Cripps and Michael Kuo. And she's been very influential in maintaining the collection and promoting the collection and growing the collection over time. But she was a microbiologist in training who worked part-time, was largely trained by Sam Mitchell. And in that whole time, they never really had a bona fide curator that would do research on the specimens. So at some point, they decided they would hire somebody. And I'm just lucky that that person ended up being me.
You came in to fill the critical role, yeah.
Yeah. So right now, with this position that I've been in for the last 4 years, what I'm essentially been trying to do is help the department sort of grow and expand its capacities to use laboratory and molecular sequence data. And we have a brand new facility and a brand new genetics lab that we've just moved into this last year. And then also learning and trying to develop ways in which we can more effectively DNA barcode specimens to explore diversity, because right now so many of the specimens are identified based on morphology. And there's a lot of genetic information that I want to explore in these collections to better understand what kind of diversity we have here in the Southern Rockies. So one of the things I'm trying to develop and working on is new methods of using these high throughput sequencing to DNA barcode hundreds, if not thousands, of specimens at a time. It's challenging, but right now I've got a great graduate student who's helping me develop this method, and also a couple of great volunteers that are also helping. And right now we have a bunch of high school students that we are employing to help with the initial processing of all of these specimens and sampling of tissues. And so it's fun, and it's weird for me because now I find myself to be the conductor. And it's not a role that I've used to. I'm used to be a master of one, but now I'm a master of a lab. So I'm learning as I go to a degree, and I'm having a lot of fun doing it. But it just feels like a slower process than I'd like it to be. I really want to start publishing more about the diversity and even the biogeographic history of Southern Rocky Mountain fungi.
Now, I'm sure there are amazing findings emerging as we're going through this work. But whenever I hear about fungal herbariums, it stands out to me as these are kind of the organic data banks that tell the story of our planet. And there's one aspect of that, which is to collecting and actually building up these collections. And then in speaking with a number of people that do work with herbariums, it seems like that next stage of actually analyzing the specimens, especially when you get to herbariums that have decades old specimens, you know, that are identified based on macroscopic features, you kind of get this itch to, why can't we just study all of the data that we have built up? And I'm sure that findings will emerge. We're like sitting on this gold mine, basically, of organic data. So it's exciting to hear from someone who kind of sees that, and you're working on methods to tease apart and really get at the amazing findings that we can glean from these amazing data banks. So, you know, obviously there's findings still emerging. You haven't published anything yet, but in terms of the Southern Rocky Mountains, is there a picture that's emerging? Is there, you know, a general pattern in the theme of the episode? Is there a general pattern emerging for that Southern Rocky Mountain ecology of fungi?
Yes, there is. I know there is. But I'm still searching for the patterns in the tea leaves, really. So right now, there have been some kind of interesting nuggets. Like, I've had some undergraduate students work on some basic projects and then shared some of the initial data with colleagues who are also explore some biogeographic and population genetic type questions, and then tell me, well, there we see these other patterns in these other groups. This is their area you want to go in to explore more to really flesh out what's going on in these groups that you're seeing in the initial data that you've gotten. I think one of the big parts for me will be, you know, when we start deploying these new methods and start getting all of this tons of data back, what is it that we're seeing? We're always starting to get some initial nuggets of information and understanding how much diversity we've actually gotten, whether or not the diversity is adequately and accurately described. There's lots of room and lots of avenues to potentially explore. Right now, what I'm trying to find is, like, we're walking down this big hallway of all these doors. Some of them are shut. Some of them are just barely unlocked. And we just want to evaluate which doors are biggest and wide open, able for us to walk through. And I think through sampling, like, some of the low hanging fruit and some of the easier questions, bigger patterns will ultimately emerge. I just have a lot of faith that this is going to happen. You just need to keep plugging away and studying these things. And, like, eventually, what patterns we will find in the Southern Rocky Mountains will also depend upon their connection to other regions. So Dr. Kathy Cripps has over 6,000 specimens from the Central Rockies and other parts of the world. And she will soon be bringing her collections and depositing them in the San Mitchell Herbarium of Fungi. So we're very much looking forward to adding that legacy of research and information to our collection, with the hope that it's going to expand our ability to explore biogeographic history of fungi in the forests of the Rocky Mountain region. I would also love to explore, you know, the Rockies, the Northern Rockies, going all the way up through Alaska and seeing whether or not those patterns actually connect to Asia and some of those histories there. So lots of questions that are open for interpretation. And right now, you almost started to hit on it, but given that we're such in an area of intense change in nature, it's going to be very interesting to try to explore and sample this diversity within the Southern Rockies, because when we switch from an El Nino to a La Nina time of year, we started to experience these extreme droughts, and it'd be fascinating to understand how these might affect fungal communities, distributions, and, you know, whether or not we find them as much as we have in the past. The other thing that's going on in Colorado is that so much of the diversity that we're sampling is right in along the Front Range in the Denver area, Denver and Boulder area particularly. We've got vast amounts of the state in the Southern Rockies to explore yet. So one of the things I'm hoping to do in the future is get out there and explore a lot of these habitats to see what new things we might be able to find. More to come, lots more to explore.
Our mountains can hide these pockets of incredible diversity, much like islands can. And speaking with people who have looked at regions like that, it's impressive the amount of diversity you can find just on elevation gradients, one mountaintop to another, with geographic distributions and how things have traveled between them. So I'm sure there'll be loads to find out about. And in that effort to expand your reach, you know, how does this work overlapped with the fungal diversity survey? And then maybe talk about how you've been able to bring, I know you're bringing high schoolers into the fold, but how you're able to tap that citizen science community, that amateur community, to assist in your efforts there at the Sam Mitchell Herbarium.
Yeah, so we've been long part of what's previously known as the North American Microflora Project, and now it's known as the Fungal Diversity Survey, which I think it would be important to mention that they sort of have pivoted in their focus. They're now really focusing on rare fungi and identifying and asking people to go out and try to find rare fungi in order to understand what their distributions are. We're still working on, I think, the original thesis of the North American Microflora Project Fundus, or Fungal Diversity Survey, which is how can we best catalog the diversity within a given region, and specifically our region. In order to do that, citizen science is going to be a really important part of it in trying to get people involved. Now, there's a challenge because there's an extra layer of effort in terms of trying to train and get citizen scientists up to speed. But it's going to be very important to tackle these problems because, as we touched on before, there's a plethora of questions. It's like a gold mine, as you can say, but if you only have a few hands mining this gold, then you're not going to capitalize on that wealth as fast as we might like to. So the hope is opening, being as open as possible and potentially training the next generation of scientists, we can also train or increase our capacities to explore these questions and mine a lot of this gold, a lot of this fascinating information, and learn more about this diversity. Because ultimately, our ability to understand the biology of these fungi is rooted in the diversity. I feel very fortunate, especially having landed in the Southern Rocky Mountain region, because over the past 4 years, this region has really exploded when it comes to the mycology that's happening here. A year after I joined, Dr. Alicia Quant started at University of Colorado Boulder, and she is a mycologist studying ascomycete fungi. She's got a big project on the Labule benialis right now. She's originally from Dr. Joey Spadafora's lab, where she got her PhD, and then she did her postdoc in Dr. Tim James' lab. In this last year, Dr. Sarah Bronco moved to University of Colorado, Denver, and she's great to have around. She is very interested in the genus Suwillis and understanding how Suwillis is important in helping trees grow in toxic or heavy metal soils. There's a lot of mines in a place like Colorado, lots of soils that have been contaminated by heavy metals, but trees still grow around there. And certain fungi are actually adapted to growing in these soils and avoiding the toxic nature of all of these, having all these heavy metals around. And so she's really interested in understanding the genetics and the physiology of, and the evolution of these relationships and these patterns. And so that combination of added mycology in the region will hopefully bring in more interest from not only students, but also these citizen scientist groups, as we start explaining that, yes, now we have sort of like a growing intellectual community that can help us explore things like the mycology of the Southern Rocky Mountain regions. If anybody is really interested in what's going on here, I would heartily encourage them to sign up for NAMA this year. The North American Mycological Association 4A is going to be in Snow Mountain Ranch in Colorado. And both Alicia and Sarah will be presenting there. Also, I will be managing the voucher collections project. So there'll be a bunch of us available, and to show off the mycology of the region. Hopefully it'll be a good year. We'll get some good rains in July.
Well, that sounds like an amazing time to sign up and go foraging in the snow mountains. And you've done a great job through this whole interview in illustrating the importance. I mean, pattern recognition gets more relevant and more useful and deterministic when you have more data to discern patterns from. So this idea of getting more people out and collecting now, is the herbarium something where citizen scientists, amateurs can contribute to? Do you have a couple of rules of thumb for people that want to do some natural history collection and contribute to this massive effort that they can adopt to maybe make better collections? And then can they contribute to this herbarium or any other herbarium out there? Is it kind of open to the public and amateurs like that as long as the collection's of a certain standard?
Yes, absolutely. I would encourage anybody who is interested in exploring and being a part in contributing to these projects to start with their local clubs and their societies, because that's going to be a good gateway and entry into studying fungi and identifying fungi. And through that, you can get to interact with some scientists like myself and start making those connections locally. So if you're in Colorado, you can join the Colorado Mycological Society. You can join them on some forays, start learning how to identify mushrooms. And then once you start realizing your level of interest, you can start ramping up in your involvement by getting in touch with individuals like myself who can offer you more in-depth training and involvement in volunteering in a place like the San Mitchell Herbarium of Fungi. We are slowly ramping up. We are starting to now to welcome back our old volunteers, as well as trying to grow programs such as a high school internship. As the mushroom season ramps up, of course, we'll all get busier, but it'll be an opportunity for me to interact with other individuals mushroom periods of time are going to be different in different parts of the country. So just be aware of when you're on your hikes, where the mushrooms are at. And if you want, find out what your local club is. And that way you can just start satisfying your curiosity.
Join that local mycology club. Always the best piece of advice. Join that local mycology club. You'll naturally develop your skills at natural history collection. And then I love how you pointed out, flesh out your own interest, because there are so many things to do with mycology. You know, make sure this is something that really you're interested in and enjoy doing, and you can work your way to make some relevant contributions to this big picture we're all trying to figure out when it comes to fungal genetics and fungal diversity. And there in the Southern Rockies, obviously this is a open-ended question, but you know, where you are in the Southern Rockies, based on what you've seen so far and what you've seen around the world in terms of diversity and distributions, how much do you think is left to uncover just in that Southern Rockies region? You could even say just near those populated areas of Denver and Boulder. But you know, how much is left to explore and discover in fungal diversity, do you think, in the Southern Rockies?
There's a lot. The San Juan Mountains in sort of like the southwestern part of Colorado, where Telluride is famously, maybe just north of Durango, is a vast forested area, beautiful mountains, and they have populations of trees and forests that are not found up here in the Front Range. And so much of my past experience is collecting fungi in the Sierra Nevada region, where there's lots of white fir, and we do have white fir in those San Juan Mountains in Colorado. So in talking with a colleague here in Colorado, Amy Honan, who's down in Western and in Gunnison, she's closer to those parts of the states. But, you know, we talk about, because we've both been in the Sierra Nevada region collecting mushrooms, and she's always saying, like, I don't see this diversity here in Colorado. I see a lot of this diversity in California that it's not here in Colorado for whatever reason. I think we would really like to explore, well, is it because that the forests are just a different kind of trees, or it's just like a different makeup of plant hosts? And I think the best way to explore those questions is to go to some of these white fir communities in the San Juan Mountains, to really see if the reason why we're not getting this similar species that we see in California is because it's just a sort of a different composition within the forests. But that's one of the big questions. And there's a lot of diversity of Lecaria in Colorado. So I think one of the next big things, and kind of what I did with my high school students, I had them start sampling all of the Lecaria tissues from the fungarium. So hoping to sequence the DNA there and then be able to come up with like a key or a guide to understanding the Lecaria of the Southern Rockies.
And it sounds like as much as getting more people out collecting and taking good samples is a huge thing. I mean, getting more people trained on these DNA sequencing techniques is going to be a massive part of the picture to catalog all these finds. And a question I had is, what do you think the future of DNA sequencing technology is? And it sounds like you're kind of on that frontier with the methods that you guys are, or the procedures and methods you guys are putting together there at the San Mitchell Herbarium. Is there any general, I mean, how does that relate to like PCR techniques other people might be familiar with, this, you know, hundreds or thousands of species at a time? How does it work in its most general sense? I know it's probably incredibly complicated.
Yeah. So there's still a number of steps of PCR that are involved, but right now it's more about aspect of barcoding, where you're adding, where you normally do a PCR, where you have some of these primers that right. target a region. But now we've got primers that have special little additions to them that when they're sequenced, we can take that data back because they will contain that little bit of added information, and that we can use computers to tease apart what samples belong to what kind of specimen, or like say dirt sample, if you just wanted to do a metabarcoding of soil. I have a lot of fellow mycologists, and one of the great things about mycology is it tends to be on the forefront of all of these methods, because fungi really are difficult to study without these tools. So right. many of my colleagues are really at the forefront. I might consider myself to be a little bit in the middle of the road or ahead of the pack, specifically when it comes to natural history collections and doing sort of systematic studies. But yeah, it's the next generation of sequencing is incredibly important. There's a lot of citizen scientists out there that are really getting involved in DNA sequencing, but these new methods provide us with a lot more opportunity because they can drive down sequence per sequence cost, and they can avoid a lot of the pitfalls of the traditional sequencing methods. The challenge is you need to also have a knowledge of the computer programming and bioinformatics that are involved, which also requires quite a bit of time and effort. But I think as we mentioned before, there's so much more to know about diversity. And when we try to get DNA sequence data out of the environment from, say, like soil samples or leaf samples, we're identifying huge numbers of fungi. But our ability to identify those fungi just from a soil sample is limited because our databases aren't adequate to identify what's there. Now, there's a difference between what our databases have and what we're finding in the soil, and then what is available in our natural history collections. We've had researchers demonstrate that if we just started sequencing all of the specimens in our natural history collections, we could probably be identifying more of these fungi in the soil because we'd be fixing and amending what is in our sequence databases. And that's kind of one of the gaps I'm hoping to fill because, I mean, so few of our natural history collections have been adequately explored from the genetic context.
It would seem like the logical starting point. We've already got this database, if you will, starting point of material to work with. And I know that there are challenges presented by that, you know, especially with older specimens and everything like that. But yeah, it seems like a huge part of this work, a great starting point for what is lifetimes of work and teasing out fungal diversity, is to start with what we have. And then that'll help us as we pull samples into the future. So yeah, really, really important work that I think you're involved with. You know, and for people that are hearing this, that are really interested, that want to find out more about you, where can people connect with you or find out more about your lab and your work?
You can always look me up at Denver Botanic Gardens website. My email is andrew.wilson@botanicgardens.org. And I'm also managing the Colorado Microflora Project website. I'm not doing a great job at it at the moment, but it's a landing page for trying to communicate the diversity of Southern Rocky Mountain fungal diversity. And I do have a lot of like laboratory protocols that I'm putting up there. So people, if they want to understand the techniques and the laboratory works that we're doing, and also sort of the research that we're doing in the fungarium itself, they can go there and see what information is available. And if they want to, I welcome anybody to try to push me to flesh out these coming soon gaps in that I've put in there. I put those as place markers saying, yes, I'm going to do this. I haven't given myself a deadline though. So if anybody wants to push me, I actually respond well to that. So I might need a little bit of that.
You might need a little push. And what's one coming soon that you hope you get to? I mean, what are one of these projects in the future that you really hope you get to tackle?
Well, I mean, the project that Gary Olds, my graduate student, is working on, and really using these Illumina MiSeq methods. They're originally developed for metabarcoding, but we just sort of added an additional step with an additional layer of barcodes to apply these methods to specimens from fungaria. And so this allows us, if we just do a single PCR2 96 well plate, which is makes sense to others, that single plate, when you combine it, can have up to 768 specimens in it. And you can amplify it to do multiple PCR2 plates at a time. And right now we've gotten all the data back and we've been analyzing it and we're finding some really fascinating results and some things that are really encouraging and exciting. So once these methods are solidified, it'd be nice to put these protocols up on the page and give people an introduction on how they can potentially apply these methods too, if they so choose.
and they can do some of this mass sequencing techniques. And maybe you're developing protocols that other herbariums will start using, and we'll start harvesting these genetic databases of fungi that we already have within arm's reach.
Yeah.
Really fascinating stuff. Now, I'm going to jump to three questions that I like to ask all my guests. Before I get there, I have to know, though, we've talked a lot about science. I can see you, though. You're wearing a Telluride shirt. You know, does your love of mushrooms extend to foraging and kind of all aspects of mushrooming? Or are you spending most of your time in the lab, you know, doing kind of the academic side of things?
I tend to be, like, these days, spending a lot of time indoors. I try to get out every season. And like, I'm actually wearing Baked in Telluride. It's a bakery in Telluride. And I tend to every season go to these events. So NAMA this year is happening in Colorado. So I'll be heavily involved in that. I'm usually involved with NAMA every year as being the chair of the vouchering committee there. I tend to teach a class in Aspen at ACES. And then there's the Telluride Mushroom Festival, which happens every year in the middle of August. And I go to that every year as well. Those are places that get me away from Denver and allow me to collect outside of the Front Range region. And we have kind of a narrow window in Colorado from which to collect fungi. And so I'm always trying to keep my eye on the weather patterns and get out when I can, when I know the mushrooms are likely to be out. Other than that, I tend to have to pick and choose my battles because I don't want to spend a lot of energy to pick and come back with like half a dozen mushrooms, especially when it's super dry out, like it can be in these sort of high elevation arid environments that Colorado is.
And especially when you have massive work in front of you at the fungarium, taking days away to get only a couple specimens doesn't seem like a great trade-off. But I know a lot of times things get posited as kind of the academic camp and the amateur camp. And I'm finding more and more, though, that things overlap far more than we might think from that dichotomy. And I had a feeling you were involved in kind of the foraging side of things, the amateur community, mycology society, not amateur in a derogatory way at all, but, you know, mycological societies and folks. So really interesting to hear about. Well, then that'll tee us up for the final three questions that I ask all my guests. And the first one, as someone who studied diversity of some mushrooms that many of us don't often appreciate, I think you'll have a great answer for this, but leave us with a mushroom that you love and why. And this does not have to be an all-time favorite. It can be one you love to eat, one that's particularly fascinating, or one you want to blow us away with that you think we may have never heard of, but a mushroom that you love and why.
Wow. Okay. I mean, I'm still stuck with Onchalostoma because of the so many questions that are involved.
A love affair with Calostoma.
Love affair with Calostoma. In large part because I'm sort of interested in what's going on with the genus because, you know, it's really abundant in some parts of the world and you're always finding it on oaks, but it's in North America, it's only associated on the East Coast. And so Calostoma cinnabarinum is the species that I'm classically associated with. And I eventually want to get back to understanding the genus in and of itself and its species to be able to do a monograph of the group. I'm probably going to kill myself later for not coming up with a more unique example than one we've already talked about, but yeah, I'm just going to stick with Calostoma for now. Oh, well, and the genus Astraeus. I really like Astraeus and I'm working on a systematic revision of Astraeus, which is related to Calostoma, part of the Sclerodermatiniae group, but Astraeus is essentially the other group of Earth stars. Everybody's interested in or knows Earth stars from the genus Geastrum.
Right.
But that's a completely different group of Earth stars. Astraeus is a group of Earth stars that is associated with the Boletales, their mycorrhizal, unlike Geastrum. That's a pretty fascinating group. There's one species of Thailand that I got roped into the study of to describe a new species. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to describe a new genus. And I kind of argued against this because one of the reasons why I argued against this of calling it a new genus within this whole group is they wanted to honor some royalty within Thailand. And I was like going, The problem with this is that when you, in the realm of taxonomy, is if you name a new name a new genus, and somebody says, well, this is not taxonomically accurate, this species that you described actually belongs to the genus Astraeus. As soon as they do that, then the genus name you gave becomes a synonym and it kind of goes away. So if you describe a new genus because you want to honor somebody, then what you're doing is you're setting yourself up for disappointment because another taxonomist can say that, well, that name doesn't mean anything. So really what you want to do is you want to keep it in the genus that it most likely belongs in, so nobody's going to mess it up. Just go ahead and name the new species in honor of the new species. And that way you can preserve that name and that specimen without, you know, somebody trying to correct erroneous taxonomy. And that, in combination of like helping them do the phylogenetic analysis and prove through phylogenetics that it was a new taxon, a new species, that was a kind of a fun episode and story where I got to name a new species, and I also got to help coach some colleagues in Thailand how they would want to do this correctly.
You taught people how to immortalize someone through taxonomy.
Yes. Yeah.
And if anyone is looking up Callistoma cinnabarinum right now, you can't go wrong with naming that as a mushroom you love. It is incredible looking, super bright red, such a strange morphology, like you said, with that stalk that is kind of gelatinous. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen anything like it until you mentioned that. So some great, great answers. And then another question that's much broader, and that is what this relationship you've developed with fungi has given to you, or what fungal organisms may have taught you, maybe some kind of spiritual perspective about connectedness, things along those lines. You know, you've developed such an intimate relationship with these non-human organisms. You know, what has that given to you?
Just a nice sense of wonder and ability to discover new stories that I can share with the world. There's way more stories out there to learn about and explore and help people figure out and share. Like the new, I'm trying to remember his name, but we know about the cicada brood X that's coming out now. And then the fungal stories that are coming out on top of that with this new metarhizome. That's the right name. I don't know if that's the genus for it, but
I think it's Massospora.
Massospora, right.
Or Massospora.
Massospora. And I mean, there's just fascinating stories within the world of fungi, and all new ones like Massospora are coming up all the time. And there's going to be a million more to discover and then share with the world. And being part of that community to be able to share those stories is what really rocks my boat. So,
but you can't ask for much more than that. I mean, you can't ask for more than two defining aspects of the human experience: wonder and storytelling. So what a gift that these organisms have given you to really empower you with both. And then the final question, what are, as we research fungi more, as we learn more about them, more of these stories emerge, what is your highest hope or aspiration for how society will change for the better as we continue to research, continue to develop our relationship with these organisms? You know, in the coming decades, how do you hope society changes for the better due to that relationship?
I guess I kind of hold out hope with this optimism that is quite often attributed to Paul Stamets and his enthusiasm and his evangelism for all things fungi, to understand how fungi can right wrongs, can help heal the environment, can help protect and stabilize ecosystems. Because we're running into a lot of these issues and these concerns now about what's going on with the planet and how do we interpret our role in that, whether or not it's, are we contributing to the problem or are we contributing to the solution? And I have hope, like many others, that by learning more about the fungi, we can also understand how much power and influence we have as being part of the solution to the environmental problems. So as far as my aspect on that, one of the best ways of understanding those possible solutions is through the study of biodiversity, because it's through that we can better study and explore all of the different ways that fungi contribute to the environment.
There's some amazing solution or fungal ally out there that's going to be able to remediate some problem of the Anthropocene period. And it's going to be through techniques and efforts like yours that are going to help us find it. Well, Dr. Wilson, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour podcast. You've given us some amazing answers, some thoughtful answers, and you've also been able to break things down for me. I know I asked some pretty basic questions. I'm just trying to wrap my head around it. You did a great job of elucidating it and communicating it in a way that is helping me understand this process that much better, and hopefully the listeners as well. So thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you very much. This was a lot of fun.